But what we do know is that if your diet is otherwise low in saturated fats, what we might call probably a healthier diet, and then you add rich sources of dietary cholesterol like eggs into your diet, you will see a jump in your blood cholesterol.
Hello, and welcome to the Plant Prescription Podcast. This podcast is all about helping you live a longer, happier, and healthier life. We will be featuring conversations with great minds to inspire you to reach your ultimate potential. My name is Muzammil Ahmed. I'm a medical student with a master's in psychology, certification in nutrition, and a bachelor's in business.
And my name is Cass Warbeck. I'm a medical student with a bachelor of science in health and fitness physiology, and I'm also a plant-fueled Muay Thai fighter. We are both plant-based lifestyle advocates who are passionate about spreading positivity, optimizing health, and promoting sustainability. Hey everyone! Today we are joined by Dr. Michelle McMacken. She is a board-certified internal medicine physician and an assistant professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine. After attending the American College of Lifestyle Medicine's annual conference in 2013, she was inspired to integrate lifestyle changes and a whole food, plant-based diet into her clinical practice. The positive changes she witnessed in her patients' health and well-being were extraordinary. Dr. McMacken couldn't just keep quiet about this new knowledge. She works tirelessly to educate not only patients, but medical students and her physician colleagues.
She's the author of multiple research articles and speaks regularly about the power of plant-based nutrition at medical conferences. And as of January 2019, Dr. McMacken is the director of an incredible initiative at New York City Health and Hospitals /Bellevue, a plant-based lifestyle medicine program. The response from the public has been resoundingly positive. This is a physician who truly strives to prescribe plants instead of pills to her patients, and we couldn't be happier to share this conversation with you all. Also, we would like to thank those of you who have left us 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts. This helps our show get discovered more easily and helps us spread our message further. If you enjoy listening and haven't done so already, please do. Thank you so much.
Hello, Dr. McMacken. We're super excited to have you on our podcast. I met you at the Lifestyle Medicine Conference in 2019 last year, and I attended your talk, and everything you shared that day was eye-opening. So I'm super excited to have you here. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm super excited to be here. I love connecting with medical students and other trainees, especially around nutrition. So this is awesome.
That's awesome. So before we get into the nitty-gritty details of nutrition, I want to hear how you got into medicine and what led you to the path that you ended up choosing.
Yeah, so I had a pretty convoluted path to medicine. I didn't really take a science class until my mid to late 20s. I was an English major and I loved literature and novels, much to my parents, I wouldn't say dismay, that's kind of a strong word, but my parents are both scientists and they were always like, why are you not taking more science classes? But it was just kind of my thing. I loved literature, and I was an English major and graduated from college thinking I would become a writer. So my first job out of college was working at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta as a writer-editor. And that was really fun because not only was I doing some of the writing and editing that I wanted to do, but I started to learn about public health. I literally knew nothing about medicine or public health. And I was working in the tuberculosis division, and so I got to see all of these physicians and epidemiologists going out on outbreak investigations and around tuberculosis. And that was really where tuberculosis and multi-drug resistant tuberculosis were taking off at that time, because it was sort of the height of the AIDS epidemic. So it was a very exciting time where there was a lot of work to do. And it got me really fired up about epidemiology and outbreak investigations. And looking back, I probably glamorized it a bit. But it was what gave me the impetus to decide to even take some science classes so that I would then apply to medical school and go to medical school. And then again, my parents were a bit dismayed because, my dad's like, he's like a hardcore research scientist. He's like, medical school, that's not real science. That's not basic research. It's like, no, you're right. It's not basic research. At least it's not going to be for me. And my mom was like, that's going to be so much work. Are you sure you want to do that? That's a long path. I was like, you guys are silly. Of course I want to do it. And I ended up doing a post-baccalaureate program. I took all of the science requisites in 1 year, took my MCATs, and then started enrolled in med school in New York at Columbia. And once I got to med school, very quickly realized that I actually, more than a passion for epidemiology, I had a passion for just connecting with people. And I decided, you know what, what I really want to do is I want to be a primary care doctor here in New York City. I want to take care of the types of illnesses that we see all the time that are way more common than tuberculosis in New York City. You know, diabetes, asthma, hypertension. And I want to do that in a way that really treats the whole patient. So I want to go into internal medicine. So I have this huge sort of breadth of knowledge and ability to take care of adults with chronic disease. So I did my residency in internal medicine, also in New York City at Cornell, Weill Cornell Hospital. And eventually, you know, started my career in this area. So that's sort of my long-winded path. I was what they call an older student all along.
I love that because you pretty much went through my journey just before me. Because I also, the first time I did a science course was like when I was 25 and a half.
There you go. We're science twins.
Yeah, exactly. And then I also started med school when I was 27-ish. So very similar. I don't have a science background. So I'm always really excited to hear from people who changed their path and came into medicine. So this is more of a curiosity question. Why did you end up picking internal medicine over family medicine when it came to primary medicine?
Yeah, I think it mostly had to do with the location that, you know, being in New York City, although there is definitely a family medicine contingent in New York City, it's a lot more, I think family medicine is more common in other parts of the country than in New York City. And so for me, it was more about practicing internal medicine. I was not as drawn to pediatrics or OBGYN. I was really drawn to adult medicine.
No, it's good to know. We're both kind of in that spot where we're trying to decide between different paths, and it's always good to hear some insight. So how did you discover lifestyle medicine? For the first part of your career, were you a more traditional internal medicine physician, like the medications and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that really the first, you know, from when I finished my residency and took my first job, the first 9 or so years of my practice, it was very reflective of what I had been taught in medical school, frankly. So I was much more comfortable with pharmacotherapy and referrals for procedures than I was with counseling patients around even the most basic aspects of diet and exercise and motivational interviewing and topics like that. So I really focused very, very heavily on that in my practice. And it really looked like the kind of practice where a patient would come in and they would have high blood pressure or borderline high blood pressure, or they would have an elevated LDL cholesterol and or pre-diabetes. And I would probably say a few things about lifestyle, but not in a way that really, I think, had an impact on the patient. And I would... In my heart of hearts, I knew that ultimately we were probably going down the road to pharmacotherapy sooner rather than later. So 10 years into my practice as a primary care physician, I started to feel, you know, that's kind of the point where I think a lot of doctors start to question, you know, okay, so let's take a look at, you know, what am I doing with my career? What is my lifestyle like? You know, am I happy in what I'm doing? And I think it started to feel like I was on a bit of a mill. It was in a mill. You know, I was just doing a lot of prescriptions. Everything was very, just a lot of documentation, fighting with the computer and the electronic health record like everybody else, and just feeling kind of stressed and not that rewarded in my practice. So that I remember, 2013, that summer, I had some extra money in the budget for continuing medical education. And I thought, well, what kind of a conference can I go to that will actually help me look at my career and figure out where I want to go next? And I thought, I really need more balance in my life. I really feel like there's something that's missing. And so for some reason, I Googled the word lifestyle. And I genuinely was not thinking about lifestyle for my patients. I was thinking about lifestyle for me. I was like, I need a better lifestyle. This is very stressful. I'm not that, you know, I'm just not that happy. And the American College of Lifestyle Medicine came up as the first hit under lifestyle and medicine. And I thought, what the heck is lifestyle medicine? And I started looking at this conference and I thought, you know, what the heck? This looks interesting. I have no idea what lifestyle medicine is, but I'll go. I have this money, I'll go. And what's the worst that can happen? So I went to this conference. It was in October in Washington, D.C. In 2013. And honestly, from the very first few set of talks, I was completely blown away. I literally remember going back to my hotel room after the first session and being so wired that I could barely sleep, because I thought, first of all, how is it possible that I was never taught how powerful these basic evidence-based lifestyle principles are for prevention and also for treatment? I mean, I think we all intuitively know that adopting a healthy lifestyle can go a long way for preventing chronic disease. But I think there's really an underappreciated sense of how much it can go for treating chronic disease. Even if it's only as an adjunct to pharmacotherapy, it's not that you have to throw all the pills out, you know, and never prescribe another medication again. Absolutely not. It's more about how do you really optimize people's risk? How do you optimize their health overall? And use every tool in the toolbox. And I was clearly not using the lifestyle tool at all. So as the conference went on and I heard more and more talks, I was like, this is it. My career has to change. Something in the way I practice, I have to make a big, big shift. And I remember literally going back to work Monday morning after the conference, and that very first, like my 9 o'clock patient was a woman in her 50s from West Africa, from Ghana. And she had a history of coronary artery disease, had already had several stents. She had diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol. And I had literally never discussed lifestyle with her, not once. And I thought, okay, well, here we go. Let's give it a shot. I have 30 hours of lifestyle education now under my belt. Let's just see how I do with this. And I just started slow. You know, I just started with like what I call the low-hanging fruit, you know, which is literally like fruit and vegetables and walking and really simple stuff. And the more I did it, the faster and more efficient I got at it, the more I saw how patients really wanted to talk about it. The vast majority of people were really excited to talk about it. And then I started seeing changes in my patients. And that woman that I saw from my patient from Ghana, literally by that appointment to the next appointment 2 months later, she had already dropped her cholesterol from just a brief conversation. And it's not every patient that's going to do that, but it just felt so good. It was almost like this is clearly the path that I'm supposed to be on.
That's amazing. Yeah. And I think it's a recurring theme that comes up, is just about sharing this information with the patients and letting them choose for themselves. And sometimes it's not our place to decide like how like deep into this someone's going to get, but at least it's our duty to at least share what we know so they can make the choice for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you do counsel your patients, are they usually on board, or do you get a lot of pushback and you have to kind of like convince them?
Well, I think that one of the strategies that's worked well for me is to pretty much bring up lifestyle and especially nutrition, because we know that of all the lifestyle behaviors, diet is probably the highest yield when it comes to preventing and treating various lifestyle related chronic diseases. So the approach that I use is I bring it up with almost every single patient at almost every single visit as a routine. So it therefore unmasks all of these patients that I had no idea would even want to talk about it. And I realized I have a lot of biases. I just assume this person's not going to change. This person's not going to want to talk about it. But I kept doing it anyway. I was like, just try it. Just see what happens. And then I would unmask all these people who were like, oh, I have pre-diabetes. I don't want to get type 2 diabetes. Tell me, what should I do? And so there are definitely patients who are not in a place to make changes, don't, you know, for whatever reason. They're not ready, they don't want to, they are dealing with huge hardships and other aspects of their life. And that's okay. So maybe at that visit, we don't focus on lifestyle. I bring it up at the next visit or in the future. And I just know that it's a very important tool in my toolbox that I'm always going to try to use. So to answer your question specifically, I would say the majority of my patients want to talk about it to some degree. And I actually don't get a lot of pushback. And that's because I kind of roll with where my patient's at. And it's not a lecture about here's what you should do. It's a conversation.
Right. I actually really like that. It's so refreshing to hear because I have discussed it with a lot of doctors at the school I'm at. And also I shadow a family doctor and I brought it up with her a few times. And the common answer I get is, but it's not like they're going to make the change. So why even spend time on it? And it's that huge assumption that goes that people have going into seeing their patient. And that's very unfortunate because we're not even giving them that opportunity to be educated and then eventually to make a change. So I think what you said is really important. So when it comes to nutrition, what exactly are you telling these patients? What type of nutrition? Because there's a lot of different types of diets. So what are you telling them to change their diet to?
Yeah, so I usually frame it around principles that are broadly supported by the evidence. So I don't necessarily say this, I recommend X, Y, or Z diet specifically. And in fact, I actually try not to use the word diet at all because the common connotation of diet is that it's temporary or that it's and or that it's for weight loss. I talk about the foods that you eat, you know, or your eating pattern. And I really recommend things that I think the nutrition community and the scientific community would broadly agree with. So for example, I generally like to divide foods and food groups into three different categories. So there's on the one hand, the category of foods that are pretty much universally acknowledged by the evidence and by experts as promoting disease or increasing risk. So those are foods like processed meats, red meats to a slightly lesser degree, that are red meats that are unprocessed, added sugars, refined grains. So all of the sort of white flour, highly processed refined grains, and then ultra processed foods in general. So those are, you know, it's really kind of hard to make an argument in favor of any of those groups. I think the best you could do if you really were setting out to do it would be to show neutrality. But that even that might be hard with some of those foods. So that's one extreme. I think on the other extreme are the foods that are pretty much universally acknowledged to show benefit. There's broad consensus that whole fruits, vegetables, legumes, like lentils, beans, chickpeas, whole grains, nuts, and seeds all reduce chronic disease risk. They're all associated with reductions in chronic disease risks. And it's very, very hard to find evidence showing harm of any of those foods. So those are two very pretty non-controversial categories. And then kind of in the middle, you have foods like poultry, eggs, dairy, and even fish to some degree, although that's probably the one that's the most arguable. These are foods that I call debatable. So you can definitely find a study showing benefit or neutrality of all those foods that are in this debatable category, but it's usually when you're comparing them to eating patterns that are very, very rich in the unhealthy foods. So it's always about what you're comparing it to. So is eating chicken better than eating bacon? Yep, it is. The evidence is pretty clear that if you're gonna have to choose between one of those two foods, it's probably better to choose the chicken. But on the other hand, is eating chicken as your main source of protein day in and day out a healthful choice compared to diversifying and eating more legumes and more plant protein? Absolutely not. You should absolutely be diversifying your protein and ideally consuming a lot more plant protein. So I kind of, the way I present it to patients is that I want you to make a shift. And of course, it depends how much the patient is in a position to do. If they're really, if it's someone who's living with an advanced chronic disease, they, if they want to see a big change in their chronic disease, they're probably going to have to make more changes. But I celebrate any movement that they make. So that's kind of how I lay it out for patients. I actually have a slide that I share with them that's basically divides the foods into these three different boxes. And I just say, listen, you know, based on, you know, I usually do a 24-hour recall with every patient. I ask them what they ate yesterday, and it's never 100% accurate, but it gives me a sense of what types of foods my patients are eating. And I just say, listen, this is broadly where I'd like you to go. I'd like you to move more into the category of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds. And how can we get you there? And how can we shift you more in that direction and making substitutions and crowding out all the foods that we know don't necessarily benefit your health? How can we sort of expand the healthy foods in your diet and frame it as a positive sort of crowding out message?
Yeah, no, that's, I love how you approach it with your patients. And again, it's like it's putting the power into their hands, and they're able to decide how far along the healthy spectrum they want to go.
Exactly.
Is it fair to say that, say, if someone has prediabetes versus type 2 diabetes, if they want to see noticeable changes and noticeable health improvements, they have to be a little more strict with their diet if they want to actually reverse something versus just prevent it? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say across the board. I think it really depends on a few different things. So I think that if a person has, if they've been living, say, with type 2 diabetes for a very long time, say they've had 30 years of type 2 diabetes and they're on high doses of insulin and so forth, that person will likely be able to benefit by making significant lifestyle changes, especially adopting a very healthy diet. I don't really ever set the expectation with patients that they can 100% reverse every chronic disease. In fact, I actually try to stay away from the word reverse because there's no standard definition of what reverse means. With type 2 diabetes, if it's someone who has a brand new diagnosis, you know, and I just diagnosed them with type 2 diabetes on their first blood test, and I say, you have an opportunity to put your type 2 diabetes into remission, most likely, by changing your lifestyle. And if they are carrying excess weight, I say that losing weight is going to be a big part of that. And not all eating patterns are created equal when it comes to losing weight in terms of long-term health. You know, there's lots of different ways to lose weight. Some of them are more healthy than others. So we're going to focus on healthy eating patterns that will support you for the long run, for longevity, as well as treating your chronic disease. And I agree, though, that probably people will have to be a little bit more aggressive about the lifestyle changes if they want to put their type 2 diabetes into remission than if they're living with pre-diabetes and they're trying to prevent type 2 diabetes. That across the board, that's probably true, yes.
I like the way you put it. That's really well put. So you work at the New York City Health and Hospitals / Bellevue. What type of hospital is this, and what type of patients do you usually get that you see and help with?
Bellevue is one of the largest safety net or public hospitals in the country. And our hospital system, which is New York City Health and Hospitals, is the biggest public hospital system in the country. And honestly, I chose to work at our hospital system right out of residency. And I've been there now 16 years because I'm incredibly passionate about working with a populations of patients that otherwise may not even be able to access care. And these are groups of patients who may not have any health insurance at all. And so without the safety net system, they would really be relegated to seeking care in emergency rooms and then potentially getting bills. So it's an incredibly rewarding place to work because, of course, I'm also working with, it draws faculty and colleagues that are equally committed to that mission of serving the underserved. And it it's also an exciting place to work because I see patients from all over the world. And it's always amazing to me that I'm still, after 16 years, I'm learning about new languages that I'd literally never heard of. So I'll see a new patient and I'll find out what language they speak. And I'm literally on an interpreter phone asking for a language I've never heard of after 16 years. And in a typical week, I do speak Spanish, but I'm using interpreter phones for French, for Mandarin, for Cantonese, for Fulani, for Wolof, for Polish, for Arabic, for Russian. I mean, I'm doing all of this counseling across a variety of languages and cultures, which makes it really even more challenging, but also even more fun.
That sounds like an amazing job. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were part of it. You're actually the director of the Plant-Based Lifestyle Medicine Program at the Bellevue Hospital. And I believe this has been going since January 2019.
Yes.
Okay. That's amazing. So can you just talk a bit about how you even started this program, how this started happening? And then I guess going forward, like, what was the interest in this program like? And since you mentioned you see so many different patients, different languages, different cultures, how is it talking about diet and nutrition to people from completely different cultures?
Yes. So for the Plant-Based Lifestyle Medicine Program, the idea for this program came from the borough president of Brooklyn. And his name is Eric Adams, and he's a really remarkable human being who himself had type 2 diabetes and put his type 2 diabetes into remission through a plant-based diet, as well as exercise and other lifestyle changes. And so he is a huge advocate for plant-based nutrition. And he felt like, if I was able to do this, why isn't this opportunity open to every single New Yorker to learn about eating a healthy diet and adopting a healthy diet, and therefore potentially dramatically altering their disease risk and their course of, if they're living with a lifestyle-related chronic disease? And he wanted to establish a program within the safety net hospital system, because therefore it would be available literally to every New Yorker. So he lobbied for that, and he's very persuasive, and the hospital system decided to invest in such a program, and it was my honor to be able to develop and run that program. So our program consists of it's amazing. It's a whole team. So it's four physicians working alongside a dietitian and a health coach. And just to give you an idea, all of the counseling that we've been talking about that I've been doing since I sort of had my lifestyle epiphany is always me alone in an exam room, pressed for time with an interpreter phone, trying to, you know, do this as fast as I can with no team, really. It's just me. And although it's been incredibly rewarding, I've always been like, it would be so awesome if I could just have a partner, someone that I could share this with. So that's the beauty of this program, is that we really work as a team. So the physician's job is to do a full assessment of the patient, talk about the role of lifestyle in addressing their specific chronic conditions, be there to support them as far as their changes and validate the role of those changes, adjust their medications, because a lot of people, when they make dramatic lifestyle changes, need less medication, and really be there to help optimize their health from the full picture standpoint. And then the dietitian counsels our patients beautifully on how to make transition to either a fully or at least a more plant-based diet. So helping patients move along the spectrum to the degree that they are interested and able. And then our health coach also, she has the ability to also talk to patients about the basics of plant-based eating, shopping, meal prep. She does stress reduction techniques with patients. She's a trained yoga instructor, meditation, and she counsels them on exercise. She's also a trained personal trainer. So we kind of cover most of the basics of lifestyle medicine through our program. And it's been incredibly rewarding to see patients come to us and within just a few months have these wonderful health benefits. And it's kind of hard to believe that I'm actually in a position to be able to run a program like this. It's really fun.
That sounds like an amazing program. That sounds like an ideal program. I feel like we need that everywhere.
Thank you. I hope that there's more. I really hope that this is the kind of thing that catches on. I know there's definitely a lot of other programs focusing on lifestyle.
That's kind of my plan and Cass's plan, to have something like this in Canada. So maybe
when
we're all done,
we'll model it after you.
That's awesome.
We can call you for tips. So what is the biggest nutrition myth that you get from your patients usually?
I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding around things like protein and carbohydrates, things that, you know, all of us have probably heard millions of times. And then, by the way, it's not just my patients who have those misunderstandings. I had those misunderstandings. The medical students have those misunderstandings. The residents have them. I do a lot of teaching, so I see it all the time. And it's just the culture and the messaging, the culture that we live in and the messaging that we get. But I think one of the things I hear all the time is my patients, for example, with type 2 diabetes has been literally drilled into them that they absolutely under no circumstances can eat, you know, they really have to limit their fruit. They absolutely can never eat rice, bread, tortillas, sweet potatoes. And some of those foods have the potential to actually be quite health promoting. And so it's actually been really, really fun to kind of undo some of those myths with my patients, because when I tell them, for example, you know what, it's actually okay if you like sweet potatoes, that's wonderful. Let's get sweet potatoes back in your life. And I have to tell them like 3 or 4 times and they can't believe what they're hearing. So the whole myth around carbs and people sort of using that term, which really is not a healthy helpful term to use, because carbs can encompass a lot of different types of foods. It can encompass everything from, you know, lollipops to lentils, or fruit to Fruit Loops. And so I really use specific food names with people, and that helps sort of debunk a lot of the myths.
Yeah, and you probably get a lot of I guess myth about protein, like majority of people are eating way too much protein, and I'm guessing you probably also have to clarify that one.
Yeah, I usually, I've actually, my approach is I don't fight with people around how much protein they're getting. I really talk about, where do you get your protein from? What are the optimal protein sources? And you can definitely meet all of your protein needs through plant sources if you choose to. And that is an absolutely helpful way to do it. But at a minimum, I encourage you to start diversifying your protein sources, because again, I'm treating patients in my primary care practice who are coming to me as who've really had very little. Most of them have never had a doctor talk to them about nutrition, and so they're coming to me very, I call it sort of unsuspecting. You know, they have no idea what we're going to talk about, and they're coming to me with, you know, diets that are very much centered around, you know, eggs at breakfast, chicken twice a day, ham, beef, and so forth. And so for them, it's a very, very radical message to say, it's okay not to have meat or eggs or cheese on your plate for one meal a day. And in fact, that would be quite good for you, to have a meal that's centered around legumes and vegetables and whole grains and fruit. And so we usually build from there. And when I keep reassuring them that they're going to get not just enough protein, but actually a very healthful kind of protein if they focus on beans and lentils. And many of my patients just culturally are, you know, they've grown up eating beans and lentils and chickpeas. And so that's a message that's also fairly well received.
Definitely good.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's awesome. We're super excited up in Canada because our new 2019, like our food guide, they actually suggest like choose plant protein over animal protein, like plant protein is preferable. So we're excited that this is slowly becoming more of an accepted message in the public eyes.
It really is. And kudos to Canada, and that food guide is such a triumph. It's really wonderful. And I look forward to the day when potentially we could follow your lead here in the States. But really, you're absolutely right. The evidence really broadly supports that. Even if you look at the Eat Lancet report, and I think we, you know, the three of us you know, probably know, and many people are realizing that it's not just the benefits for human health, it's the benefits for planetary health, and that those are very, very interconnected.
Absolutely. I'm just speaking about protein. One follow-up question, because this is another question a lot of people tend to have a misconception on. They'll be like, okay, but plant protein is not complete, or I need to like mash things to make it complete. So how do you answer that?
Yeah, I think that there is there has been that myth around the quote unquote complete protein for many years, and it was never shown to be true in the first place, and it's not true now. So it is definitely possible to get all of your amino acids through consuming a variety of different sources of plant protein. So if you choose to have, for example, lentils, tofu, soy milk, nuts, seeds, beans, chickpeas, whole grains, vegetables, and even to some degree fruits, but really it's falling on the whole grains and the legumes, you are going to get a complete complement of amino acids if you're really consuming diverse plant sources. You don't need to combine them at the same meal. So that was another myth that's been around, is that if you're having just beans at your meal, then you're going to be missing some amino acids that you might find in rice, for example. And it's okay. The human body is remarkably ingenious, and we're actually able to we have a window of time where we can get the variety of amino acids into our body around 24 hours or so. And as long as you're consuming diverse sources of foods, which I recommend, you know, diverse sources of plant foods, which I recommend for everybody, you will get the different amino acids that you need.
Absolutely. I think a good way to look at it is you don't eat one thing and you get all your vitamins. Like, you know, you get your vitamins throughout the day by eating a variety of things. So we need to stop thinking of protein the way we have been, and we should be thinking of amino acids same way as vitamins. Like, you eat variety of foods, just like you'll get variety of vitamins, you'll get variety of amino acids, and your body is smart enough to put it all together. You don't have to think about that. So right. I want to, before, because I do have a lot of questions about cholesterol, before I ask you about that, you probably get patients, I'm assuming, that are below the poverty line. How do you work with them when it gets to eating more plants? Like, is that feasible for them? Like, you know, how does that play out?
It's definitely feasible for them. I would say probably the majority of my patients are living at the U.S., you know, at the federal poverty line, for at least for New York, or below it. So that's, I'm used to, almost all of my counseling is in the context of people living with profound socioeconomic barriers. I think the issue, you know, when you look at different eating patterns and how they compare to what people actually typically spend on their diet, there was a really amazing study published last year, which I can share with you if you want for the notes. Mm-hmm. Looking at, say, of the quote unquote healthy eating patterns recommended by the USDA, one was vegetarian, one was Mediterranean, and one was healthy US. I don't really know what that is, but those were the three different eating patterns that were looked at, and they compared it to the cost to eat per day according to those different eating patterns. They looked at that compared to what Americans typically spend on diet per day. And the only eating pattern of those three that was the same as what Americans currently spend was the vegetarian or plant-based eating pattern. So it's, in some ways, it's kind of a myth that eating healthy is more expensive. It can definitely be more expensive if you're buying more convenience foods, or depending on, you know, where you're shopping, if you're buying organic, obviously all of those things might drive up the cost. But if you're focusing on the staples, so if you're focusing on root vegetables, if you're focusing on vegetables, especially frozen, which are nutritionally really, really can match fresh vegetables. If you're focusing on whole grains, especially bought in bulk, you and some nuts and seeds, those are actually, for most of my patients, those can fall into their budget. And of course, legumes. Legumes are probably the most cost-effective food that's out there because they're incredibly, incredibly nutritious for you and very, very, very inexpensive. So I really work with patients around busting the myths that they have to go to an expensive grocery store and buy organic and buy some product that has some natural label on it. It's really about what's right under your eye at your grocery store that you might not be thinking about buying, but that's just, you know, it's not the glamorous option, but it actually is probably the healthiest option for you. So I think what's more of an issue is access, at least in the patients that I take care of. So in New York, we're actually quite lucky because we have these produce carts. They're called the green carts that are stationed throughout New York City, and they actually sell fresh produce, at least in the spring, summer, and fall months, at a much lower cost than you might find at many grocery stores. So that's great. We have a lot of farmers markets. But the quality of produce in some grocery stores in some neighborhoods is not great. There may not even be a grocery store in some neighborhoods. So there's definitely issues around access, but cost I have not found to be as much of an issue as you might expect. So in terms of how I counsel patients, again, I'm really just focusing on, I always start with where the patient's at. So I ask them about where do they buy their foods now? You know, where are they shopping now? And for patients that are not cooking, that's another level of counseling that we try to get into. For patients who are cooking and they're going to the grocery store, the first conversation we have might be, here are three types of foods that I would recommend that you start incorporating more into your diet. It might be some vegetables, either fresh or frozen. It could be legumes, and it could be something like brown rice. And I send them on an assignment between now and the next appointment. At your grocery store, can you just locate where those foods are in your store and take a picture of the brands that you see, and let's talk about it at the next appointment. You can start so simple. And then if they don't know how to, you know, then the next appointment, if they don't know how to make brown rice or cook it or buy it, you know, then you can start counseling on how to do that and how to incorporate it more into the diet. So it really depends where the patient's starting from. And I try very hard to be a detective around what their day-to-day life and is really like, and also what their family situation is, because if they start cooking brown rice and their spouse is like, what is this? You know, I've never had this before. We're going to have to work around that. So I have a lot of tricks up my sleeve.
That's amazing. And especially what you said about legumes, that's something I didn't know until I went plant-based, was how cheap they are. Like when I used to buy animal sources of protein, my budget for diet was a lot higher than when I just started buying lentils and beans and chickpeas, and my budget dropped significantly. So I think that's like a huge key point, is to buy legumes, and it's even cheaper if you just buy them dry and in bulk, then it's just like dirt cheap. So I want to get into dietary cholesterol, because that is one thing where there's a lot of confusion. And so a lot of people believe that either dietary cholesterol doesn't matter, or that it's essential for your body for you to consume.
Yes, a lot of people do believe that.
So how do you respond to that?
Especially the first point. So let's tackle the second point first. There is absolutely no need to consume cholesterol in your diet. There is absolutely no need. Our bodies are capable of making all of the cholesterol our bodies need, and then some. So there should be very little debate about that second question. And so there's that. With the first question, that's a much more complicated question around whether the cholesterol that you consume affects your blood cholesterol. So, and the reason it's so complicated is that it turns out that the cholesterol you consume in your diet is not the number one factor that drives up your blood cholesterol. The number one food factor that drives up your blood cholesterol is the presence of saturated fats in your diet. And so saturated fats are typically found in animal foods, They're, you know, for example, cheese is very rich in saturated fats. Red meats have saturated fats. Sort of full fat animal products typically contain saturated fats. And they're also found in the plant world in the form of tropical oils. They're very rich, for example, in coconut oil and coconut products, as well as palm oil. And to some degree, they're found in all fat rich foods. So even avocados or nuts have a little bit of saturated fats, but much less than, they're more predominant in other fats. So saturated fats are, what they do is really affect the LDL receptor in the liver. And so they basically end up translating into higher blood cholesterol levels. And it's not a question of whether consuming saturated fats will increase your LDL. It's a question of how much for each person, but it's fairly linear. The more saturated fats in your diet, the more your LDL will go up. There are some other factors that might weigh against that. For example, if you're losing weight, that might counterbalance the saturated fats in your diet to the degree of just, if you're just purely looking at your LDL level. But in general, saturated fats drive up your LDL. So going back to cholesterol, what a lot of the studies that have looked at dietary cholesterol have done is they've taken patients that are already consuming high amounts of saturated fats, as you might find in the typical American diet. And then if you add on, you know, a couple of eggs per day to a diet that's already very rich in saturated fats, you're really not going to see a huge difference. It's kind of a drop in the bucket effect. And therefore they say, oh, dietary cholesterol doesn't matter. But what we do know is that if your diet is otherwise low in saturated fats, what we might call probably a healthier diet, and then you add rich sources of dietary cholesterol like eggs into your diet, you will see a jump in your blood cholesterol. And then there's other things about foods that contain dietary cholesterol, which, by the way, by definition, dietary cholesterol is only found in animal foods. That, independent of that cholesterol, it's coming along with other elements, other nutrients that may not necessarily be health promoting. So for example, typically you're getting dietary cholesterol along with heme iron or along with other substances that might increase your risk of chronic disease. So when you look at the whole picture, what I like to tell my patients is, at the end of the day, you don't need to consume cholesterol. So if you choose not to consume foods that contain cholesterol, nothing bad will happen to you. Probably only good things will happen to you. If you are eating a diet that is otherwise very healthy and you choose to add on foods that contain cholesterol, we may see a small rise in your blood cholesterol. But the idea is really that you should really lower your saturated fats in your diet if you're living with high cholesterol. And by definition, that means you'll probably be lowering your dietary cholesterol too, because they track together in the same foods for the most part.
No, you explained that so well. Just another common kind of misconception, I guess, or topic that kind of surfaces when people think about their cholesterol levels is their HDL level. And people think that if their HDL is high, then that's protective. And regardless of their LDL level, they'll be protected against heart disease. What are your thoughts on this?
Right. So it's when I went to medical school, that's what I was taught. And I went to medical school a long time ago.
They're so, still teaching the same thing.
Oh, boy. No, I mean, I think that what the current evidence shows and what the thinking has been for the past 10 years or so or more possibly is really that it's not so much about the HDL number. So the number that we see when we do a blood test showing your HDL. That level. It's much more about the function of your HDL molecules. And that's really called the efflux capacity. So how well does your HDL function as a scavenger molecule to rid the body of cholesterol? And you don't see that in a typical blood test. That's an experimental test that can be done. But your level of HDL does not correlate with its efflux capacity, with its function. So you might have a level of HDL that's looks low, but your efflux capacity is great. And therefore, raising your HDL, just raising the number, does not necessarily mean that you're going to get a long-term benefit in terms of cardiovascular risk reduction. In fact, we have a number of drug studies that have shown that when you raise HDL, that does not necessarily translate into benefit at all. And to my knowledge, there's literally never been a study showing that raising HDL benefits people in terms of long-term cardiovascular risk. It just is a marker. People that happen to have low HDL, it's typically part of a metabolic syndrome in the same people that are living with high triglycerides, potentially impaired fasting glucose or insulin resistance, abdominal obesity and hypertension, all of the things that we know do increase cardiovascular risk. But that doesn't mean it's the HDL itself. It's just part of a marker of this overall condition. And so I actually see in my own patients who adopt a healthier diet, say they're adopting a plant-based diet and they're reducing the saturated fats in their diet, their HDL might drop. And sometimes they panic and I say, that's actually not a problem. Probably your HDL molecules are healthier molecules that are more, they have more, you know, improved function. And not only that, we know that saturated fats actually have the ability to render HDL as a pro-atherogenic or pro-inflammatory molecule. So HDL is not always sort of the good angel circulating in our bloodstream. It can actually become pro-inflammatory depending on the other foods that we eat. So in those same patients whose HDL might go down if they're eating a very healthy diet, their LDL goes way, way down proportionally. And their overall lipid panel, and their what we call the non-HDL cholesterol. So all of the atherogenic particles in their bloodstream, that goes down. And that's really the most important predictor of risk. Mm-hmm. And again, I can share with you some articles on this for your notes if you want.
Yeah, please, that would be great.
Love that. I'm glad you brought that up because that seems to be the biggest confusion. I know that for myself, a long time ago, I did keto diet, and this is way before I learned about plant-based nutrition, and my LDL and HDL went up. But my doctor wasn't as concerned. One of the doctors I saw wasn't as concerned because my HDL was high. But then I saw another doctor and they were very concerned. That's when I decided to completely stop the keto diet and learn more about nutrition. And then all my cholesterol went down, including my HDL. And it's really important for you to mention that HDL going down isn't much of a concern if your LDL is dropping tremendously, because that is something to really be worried about if that's high. We touched on saturated fat in relation to heart disease. What role does it play when it comes to type 2 diabetes? Because it's not, you're eating one thing, but it's not just causing one disease, it's causing like multiple diseases in your body.
Right. So with type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance in general, I'm very humbled by how complicated it is. And every time I think that there's just one culprit, it's never just one culprit. So saturated fats have been implicated in the development of insulin resistance because saturated fats have been shown to promote the buildup of certain lipid subspecies in the skeletal muscle, in the hepatic tissue. When you have the buildup of these lipid subspecies in the liver and in the skeletal muscle, that tends to promote insulin resistance. But it's very hard to tease out because it's not just the saturated fats. It is also other elements sort of, I mentioned heme iron before, and heme iron has been very closely linked with the development of numerous chronic diseases. So heme iron, of course, is iron that comes from animal sources, as opposed to non-heme iron, which is iron as you might find in spinach or lentils. So heme iron or animal sources of iron definitely have been linked to the development of insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. You're also getting, there's multiple other factors that kind of play into the development of insulin resistance. But I will say that there's also the absence. If you're focusing a lot on foods that contain saturated fats, you're probably missing out on foods that actually are highly protective against insulin resistance. And those are namely foods that are in their whole form that contain fiber, which is plant foods. So Fiber has been linked to far lower rates of type 2 diabetes, and it's also wonderful for your gut microbiome in terms of having your, it's really the number one food that your gut bacteria like to feed on. And when your gut bacteria feed on fiber, they produce substances called short chain fatty acids, which themselves have been shown to be linked to reductions in insulin resistance, as well as a number of other benefits, like the health of your colonic epithelium and reduction in colon cancer risk and so forth. So you're missing out on fiber if you're focusing a lot on foods that contain saturated fats. You're also missing out on probably on a number of antioxidants and other phytonutrients and vitamins that you that have been shown to be protective against insulin resistance. So it's really a very, it's a complex matrix of things that combine to increase or decrease your risk of insulin resistance. And I, in general, I try very, very hard to keep my mind nimble around letting new information come in and while still trying to hang on to a framework that I can understand. I will just tell you that in my practice, I have seen enough patients go from having very poor glycemic control and having a new diagnosis of type 2 diabetes to going into complete remission by adopting a plant-based diet. And it's definitely not the only way to treat type 2 diabetes with diet, but it is a way that I know is consistent with dietary guidelines for long-term health. It's consistent with lowering your risk of cardiovascular disease, which is the number one cause of mortality for people with diabetes. It's also been shown now, we have a lot of evidence around lowering the risk of progression of chronic kidney disease, the more plant-based proteins you consume and the more fruits and vegetables you consume. And of course, diabetic nephropathy is a huge issue for people with type 2 diabetes. It goes along with reduction in body weight for people who are overweight. And it's also been shown to be linked to lower cancer risk reduction. I don't know if you've seen the latest American Cancer Society guidelines focusing on more plant protein, more fruits and vegetables, right? I figured you probably had. So when I recommend a fully or mostly plant-based diet, a diet centered around plants for my patients with type 2 diabetes, not only do I know that their blood sugar is going to get better, but it's going to be for the big picture of their cardiovascular risk and their life and their overall longevity, it's probably going to carry a big benefit. And I don't think you can say that for a lot of the other dietary patterns that are being promoted for type 2 diabetes.
Absolutely. That was so well put. And I, like you said, it's not just one thing that plant-based diet helps with. It's everything. It's a very holistic way of going about diet. It covers all your bases and then protects you from various diseases. So we usually like to end our conversation with our guests with three questions. So we're just going to ask you and see what you come up with.
Oh, boy.
First question, what is your favorite plant-based meal?
Oh, my favorite plant-based meal. Okay. So I'm a huge fan of, are we talking breakfast, lunch, or dinner?
Anything. Yeah. One of each, whatever you like.
I'm trying to get three answers out of this question. That's what I'm trying to do.
Let's hear one of each then.
Okay. Well, I mean, really, I'm for breakfast, I'm just a huge oatmeal person. It's almost a joke. Every day, in the summertime, it's overnight oats or even muesli. So I love just literally old-fashioned rolled oats. I'm a soy milk girl myself. I like unsweetened soy milk and frozen berries that I let kind of defrost and some walnuts. That's like my dream breakfast. So that's breakfast. Lunch and dinner. Lunch is often, that's a time for me to get, I really like having a salad that's sort of a really like super duper filling salad that contains a base of greens. And then I always add a grain, usually quinoa or brown rice, and a legume, because otherwise I will definitely get hungry. And I usually have avocado, and I really make it to the point where it can carry me through the afternoon. So it's not romaine and some tomatoes. I mean, it's really a pretty high calorie lunch salad. And then dinner, so I love pasta. I love having whole wheat pasta with tomato sauce and veggies. I actually usually add legumes to my pasta. So I'll add chickpeas to pasta. I have a really yummy recipe that I love that has made chickpeas and tomato paste and garlic and whole wheat pasta. I love making lentil tacos or black bean tacos. That's another, especially in the summer with corn and cilantro and tomatoes and radishes and red cabbage. I'm getting hungry talking about this.
You're making me. I can see how passionate you are about food.
I could go on.
No, it's so good. We eat very similar. I literally had a giant bowl of blueberry oatmeal right before this interview.
Awesome.
All right, our second question here. Sorry, what is your favorite kitchen item?
Oh, kitchen item. Good question. I would say probably either. It's a good question. I think I'm gonna have to go with a good sharp chef's knife. And in our house, my husband's actually a much better cook than I am. And he does a lot of the cooking and I do a lot of the cleaning. But when it's my turn to chop, I really count on having a knife that works properly. So I'm going to go with that.
That's an important one. Okay. Third question. What is one final piece of advice or takeaway you would like to leave for our listeners?
So I would say, to the extent that I know probably many of your listeners are medical trainees, is it safe to assume that?
We have both kinds, but yeah, medical trainees and general public.
Okay. Well, really for your medical, so let me, can I, I'll cheat and give you two answers for
okay,
this one also.
Awesome.
Because I think for your medical, for anyone who's a medical student or thinking of going to medical school or in residency, or heck, even out of residency, anyone in the medical field, I would just say it has been nothing short of transformative for me in my career to see face-to-face how powerful lifestyle medicine can be. And not only has it really changed the lives of my patients in terms of their health outcomes, but it has also changed the arc of my career and my satisfaction with my career. It's connected me with my patients in a way that I never thought imaginable. I mean, there's nothing that can connect you with a patient like being on an interpreter phone in a language you've never heard of, talking about what you both like to eat. I mean, that's just fun. I'm sorry. but in reality, it has really helped me understand their lives in a way that I never would have otherwise. And so it's been incredibly rewarding. And then it's been rewarding just to see people transform their health, particularly the patients who've, you know, put their diabetes into remission. So that's the message that I would share with anyone in the medical field is just don't let your own eating habits or your own lack of training in lifestyle medicine hinder you from exploring this area. It's not that overwhelming to just learn the basics. And there's a lot less confusion than you might think about the evidence. There's actually very broad principles that many, many people agree with. And focusing on that and talking to your patients about that with humility, because none of us are perfect. I don't have the perfect lifestyle habit, but you don't have to have the perfect lifestyle to counsel your patients on lifestyle. So that's a long-winded message for your medical trainees and for your audience that's not in the healthcare field. I would just say, encourage your doctor or whoever's your healthcare provider to talk to you a little bit about this and to learn yourself a little bit about it, because it can also be very, very beneficial for you and your lifestyle. And even if you don't have any chronic diseases at all, most people just simply feel a lot better, in addition to reducing their long-term risk, when they adopt healthier lifestyle habits.
Perfect. Thank you so much. If our listeners would like to reach out and connect with you, learn more about what you're doing, where can they find you?
So I am on Instagram and Twitter in both cases as veg_MD. the veg like vegetable, _MD. And that's probably the best way to find me.
Okay, we'll definitely add that to the show notes so people can reach out. Well, thank you so much, Dr. McMacken, for being on our show. It was super educational and a lot of fun.
Thank you, guys. It was an honor to be here and to talk with you.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for listening to the Plant Prescription Podcast. We really hope you enjoyed it, and hopefully this inspires you to take steps towards making changes so you live a longer, happier, and healthier life.
You can also follow us on Instagram, where we share nutrition, health, and fitness content, along with recipes. Our Instagram handles can be found in the description of this episode. Please make sure to subscribe so you don't miss on any upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed this, we would love it if you left us a positive review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Please also make sure to share this with any family or friends who may benefit. Thank you so much for listening.
Also, be sure to eat plenty of plants and see you next week.